Welcome to Invictus Games Radio. I'm PJ Kwong. The Invictus Games Toronto 2017 take place September 23rd to 30th and will harness the power of sport to inspire the recovery of wounded, ill, and injured servicemen and women. This podcast shines a light on the stories of those competing in the games and those surrounding them. Their spirit is unconquered. On this episode, an archery medalist from the Invictus Games Orlando 2016 Canadian team. He's a retired corporal who served with the Canadian Army and who suffered physical injuries like a herniated disc as well as PTSI, or post-traumatic stress injury, as a result of his service. In this podcast, we're going to find out how activity helped him in his recovery. I am delighted to be talking to Joel Gandahl. How about that?
Hi, PJ.
Hi there. I did it.
Yeah, you did it. Really good. Really good. Thank you for having me. It's very nice to be here.
Well, it's wonderful to have you. So I wanted you to take me back to little Joel. When and why and how did you decide to join the military?
Wow. That's a big question. I decided to join the military back in 1998. I was considered to be of the older generation at the time I joined. And it's something I've always wanted to do.
Now, what does that mean, older generation?
I was 28 at the time.
Okay, so you'd already been out in the world for a little bit.
Yes, I had experience. I went to school, worked full time. I had experience as a working civilian, so to speak, compared to the people that I was with when I joined the military. They were a lot younger. I was the oldest in my group, in my platoon. So I'd always been, strong. I followed the armed military a lot. One of my cousins was active at the time. It still is, by the way. And so I had followed everything. I watched thousands of documentaries about it, and I was extremely patriotic.
From the time you were a child?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I've always considered myself a Canadian. You know, I looked at the flag. I understood at a young age what it meant and what it represents, what our country is, how our country is viewed by the international community. And as I grew older, I said, but it's now or never. I have to sign up and do my part. And that's the way I felt. So I joined, and I wanted to serve overseas. I had a tremendous amount of respect for. People went and actually participated in the combat part of the past conflicts, and my goal was to reach a reconnaissance platoon. I want to be a reconnaissance patrolman.
Now, what does that mean to people who don't know?
A reconnaissance patrolman basically is it's a small group of men that are self-sustained. They are usually dropped behind enemy lines. They go and perform surveillance on whatever target it is. It might be a building, a group of people. They gather information, bring the information back to command, and help them decide if there needs to be action taken upon that the target that they surveilled. So it's not very. They're not part of the actual combat. They participate in it once it starts, but the more they're in terms of surveillance, they can participate once the decisions take to take action upon the surveillance intelligence gathered. And but they're also the last ones out.
Mm-hmm.
Once the attack is done, and once the actions are completed, they stay there and they perform surveillance to see what
sure
else is
completed.
Going on. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I've always wondered, when you're working with a group of people, does everybody see the same thing? So when you all come back to whoever to whom you have to, give the information, does everybody have the same perception, same point of view? Like, do you operate as a group in that way as well? Or does it depend where you each are physically?
No, I think we all see the same thing.
Okay.
I mean, we have, when we go overseas, I've performed two missions, one in Bosnia and one in Afghanistan. And one thing I noticed is before we go out on whatever it is, the mission that we're tasked to do, whether it be a humanitarian aid or protecting somebody, a high-ranking general, we're fed the information we need to perform the job. And when we're out there, we're all trained to look for the same things, do the same things, because I have to know my partner's job, the guy next to him,
okay.
the guy next
yep.
to me, the guy next to him, and so on, so that if one should happen to fall during the mission, I'm able to perform his duties also.
I see.
So I might be tasked with duty A, while my brother's tasked with duty B, but I know what his duty B is, so if E falls, I can perform both.
And do you think that this kind of close work, this is what creates that bond that they talk about in military service? The fact that you guys have to work, men and women, obviously, I just use the term guys just generically, but
yes.
the fact that you are in a situation together, that creates that bond, it seems to me.
It's a part of it. It's part of the equation. But I think what creates the biggest bond is that everywhere I went, no matter who I was working with, whether it be, the bond transcends into other military units. When I worked with the Brits, the French, the Americans, and that's what I base the camaraderie on, is that if you fall, you know they won't leave you there.
Okay.
No matter what happens, they will not leave you there. So you know you could put your life in their hands, and you know you believe in the fact that they can put their lives in your hands. I will do whatever it takes to protect my brother, because I know he will do everything it takes to protect me so that we all come back and succeed in the mission that we're given. So that feeling, knowing that no matter what happens, you will not be abandoned, is in my opinion, what helps build such a strong, and to this day, unbreakable bond. You know, mm-hmm. I'm a veteran, I'm out of the military, but the guys I served with, I don't care if they call me at 2 a.m. or 2 p.m. If they need help, I'm picking up. If I need to be there, I'm driving up there. You know, I've been put in situations where the last couple of months where there's been suicide attempts.
Mm-hmm.
I make myself available if they can't, they need to talk directly and see my face, we'll use Skype because we live at the 5-hour drive. If I need to be there, I will drive up there. That bond transcends everything. It's unbelievable. And you spoke about that bond, and I'll tell you a story that better explains the bond. When I was in Orlando, I wanted to meet
for the 2016 games.
Yes, for 2016 games. Sorry about that. I didn't mention that. When I was in Orlando, I had asked if I could speak, if I could have a moment, 30 seconds. To have a talk with Prince Harry, and just because I want to convey my thanks for what he's doing, and I was said sure, yeah, we'll try to make it happen, but it was hard because his agenda is a lot more packed than mine.
Yeah.
But I was walking on the Invictus site, and I saw him talk to a group of people, and there weren't any journalists around, there weren't any cameras, so it looked like it was just him having a moment. So I said, you know what, I'll interrupt him. And I'll go and talk to him, because despite the fact that he has the title of Prince, he fought in Afghanistan.
Mm-hmm.
So to me and other people, he's part of the band of brothers mm-hmm. / sisters. You know, we're all part of this group. And I had to thank him personally. Like, I thank people for their service. I thank the brothers I've served with. I had to thank him for what he's doing with Invictus Games. So I went up to him and went against protocol. You're not supposed to touch him until he reaches his hand out to shake yours. I put my hand on his back and I said, excuse me, sir, can I interrupt you for a second? Obviously, the security, they all came in and they got closer to us, but he signaled to them, everything was fine. And he said, sure, what can I do for you? I said, I'd like a word with you in private if you don't mind. So he said, sure, let's do that. I said, I respect your title of Prince, but right now I'd like to thank you as a brother, you know, as a band of brother in arms. I really appreciate the fact that you put together these Invictus Games, because they've done so much for me in terms of recovery and bringing me back to the person I was before I got diagnosed with post-traumatic stress injury. And, it was a genuine conversation, and it was based on the fact that both of us fought for the same cause. I know for a fact that if I were on that line the day, on a specific day, and he was there, he would have done the same for me as I would have done for him,
like yes.
as I would have done for anybody else there. So that camaraderie transcends international borders, social status, whatever. It's very hard to explain, very hard to conceive, but every person I served with, I consider them as much part of my family as my sons, my wife, my parents, my sister. You know, we're that close.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You know, when you talk about the fact that you had a herniated disc, which is
yes.
no joke, and then you have post-traumatic stress injury, diagnosis with each of these, what is the difference in coming to terms with a physical injury versus an invisible wound?
I think that, you know what, the physical injury, serving in the military, you're taught to ignore the pain and continue.
Mm-hmm.
I find that with a physical injury, where you actually feel an actual pain, obviously that is just my perception of it. I feel the pain of my lower back. I also, I've also been diagnosed with a degenerative disc disease because of my military service. So I feel that pain, but I don't. It's not something that actually I lose sleep over.
Okay.
You know, I've learned to accept that very easily because, you know, the physical work and what I did was extremely demanding, and I knew when I started that eventually my body would
say no.
Would suffer.
Yeah.
Yeah. It would come to that. But the psychological injury, and I'm not proud to say that, but that's reality. I think it's important that we say that. At first, when I was first introduced in the military to the possibility of at the time they call it post-traumatic stress disorder, of getting that, my automatic reaction was, well, it's not going to happen to me.
Sure.
You know, I'm a soldier.
I'm
not going to happen to me. Yeah, exactly. You adopt that macho way of thinking, which is, to a certain extent, normal because of where I was, infantry.
Mm-hmm.
Infantry, you're taught to be tough. You're taught to be a machine. And PTSD is not going to happen to you. You know, I remember we were sitting in the big room before we were about to leave for Bosnia, first tour in 2002, and a gentleman was there specifically to talk about post-traumatic stress disorder. And he got up on stage and he said, I was in Bosnia in 93. And
so he's a soldier talking about it.
He was a veteran.
Doctor. Okay,
a veteran. He retired. But he retired because of post-traumatic stress disorder. And he was commenting on the symptoms and signs that he had. And I remember, and obviously, it's the truth, and I'm telling it because it has to be told, because that's the mentality that we had. When we were sitting and listening to him, to me, everything he was saying was like, that's impossible. How can somebody be affected like that? And, I mean, there's no physical injury.
They look like a normal person.
Yeah,
walking
exactly.
Around. Yep.
So, you know, some people made jokes. I made jokes. I regret having done that today because I discovered that, you know what, it's a lot more serious than it is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's no excuses for what I, for the way I reacted, but I wasn't. I was misinformed. I was not educated about it. Obviously, I wasn't suffering from it before.
And you know what? You need to not beat yourself up because now when you know better, you do better. You didn't know
yes.
at the time.
Yeah, I don't beat myself up for it.
Good.
But at the same time, when I look at all that and see where I am today, I find that it's a lot harder to deal with operational stress injuries because that mentality is still alive. In the military and out of the military, in the civilian world. And I don't mean to be to talk about military and civilian world, but there are two separate things.
Well, it's continuing to evolve because up until very recently, people couldn't really appreciate or accept the fact that there were invisible wounds. They just thought, well, you've recovered. You don't have scars. You're fine.
Agreed.
So it's taking people a certain amount of time to understand that this is actually a real problem.
Yes, it is. It's actually a very real problem. I mean, obviously, I've noticed that there's a lot of progress. There's been a mm-hmm. lot of progress. And, you know, events like the Invictus Games, organizations like True Patriot Love, Soldier On, Wooden Warrior, I mean, they help a lot not only helping those that suffer with OSIs and physical injuries, but also with building awareness about mental illness and how it doesn't destroy a person. It's an injury.
Mm-hmm.
You can overcome it. You know, they help you realize that. And society is seeing that people who've been disabled, they're coming back from their disability or their injury and actually leading productive lives again.
Mm-hmm.
So the work, I mean, there's obviously some progression, but there's still work to be done.
Of course.
That stigma is still alive.
So tell me a little bit about when you didn't quite realize that you were suffering from PTSI. If somebody's listening to this today, what kind of symptoms were you exhibiting that finally made you realize that there was something going on?
Well,
and are you back in Canada at this point?
Yes, I was back in Canada.
Okay.
While I was overseas, nothing hit me over there. No matter what the situation, no matter how stressful, no matter how ugly the scene was, no matter how horrific it was, I always managed to do my job, and I managed to really numb myself out. My emotions were non-existent over there, you know. The general we were protecting come in and beyond it and said, one of the things I really appreciate about you is the fact that no matter where we are, no matter how stressful or horrific it is, you're always calm. You always make the right decisions. And he said that it gave him confidence.
Mm-hmm.
So when we got out somewhere, he looked at me, and those were his words. I looked at you, and I saw how calm you were. It made me feel comfortable. So
you did
when
your
I
job.
Reflect on that, I think, well, I didn't have signs and symptoms when I was there. A month after I came back, when I noticed that there was something wrong, it was because I had been back a month, but the rage, the anger that comes with war zones, it sounds bad to say, but you need those to survive. The rage, the anger, the adrenaline rush, the hyper state of vigilance, the controlled fear were still there.
You were feeling controlled fear? You were feeling controlled fear?
Yeah. Wow. There was always fear present everywhere I went.
Okay.
It's just that I was able to control that fear and use it to my advantage. You know, fear in a certain extent sort of heightens your senses.
Yes, okay.
If you control it, if you don't let the fear control you. But that fear started to become uncontrollable, starting to get the best of me. You know, I associated certain events with either smells or sights, feelings, sounds, and that fear got controlled by that association,
mm-hmm.
and sort of started developing. And then the nightmares came, panic attacks. I had panic attacks day or night.
Yep.
Since the games, I don't have panic attacks during the day.
That's wonderful.
Yeah, that's perfect. So I have them at night when I wake up. I wake up from a nightmare right into a panic attack. I'm unable to digest those emotions enough to say, I'm having a panic attack. You know, it happens. It just goes full-fledged. And that's what I'm working on right now with my psychologist.
Mm-hmm.
But so after a month, I came back. That's when I realized that there was an issue.
You talk about being a husband and a father.
Yes.
And you've got this family and you're trying to sort of build your life in Canada again. You're trying to sort of reconcile what's happened to you with what you're experiencing at that time. How long did it take for you to get to a point where you wanted to start doing activity? Because you talked about it once where I heard you sort of being kicked, dragging and screaming sort of out of the basement.
Yep.
So tell me about that moment in that time.
It took 10 years.
10 years?
Yes, 10 years
wow.
after I was diagnosed.
Oh my goodness.
Yeah, when I was diagnosed, things started to go downhill. Because I was, originally, I was that type of guy who never quit. You know, I wasn't the fastest, the strongest in the military, but one thing is that I never quit.
Yep.
I never said, you know what, I quit, get me out of here. And no matter how hard or how rough things were, my reconnaissance course was one of the hardest things I've done in my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I never said I quit. I completed it, you know. So
never say die.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So when that hit me, I started quitting certain things, basically quitting on myself. You know, stopped fighting and started searching for something that would help me avoid any triggers. And
so when you're talking about a smell or a sound, if you think you're going to hear that sound, you avoid that place. Is that what
exactly,
you mean?
Exactly. Mm-hmm. So I went downhill. I got to a point where I had to choose. I chose what I call quote drug unquote. I chose my drug of choice, and my drug of choice was not the actual drugs or alcohol or gambling or pornography. My drug of choice was Netflix.
Netflix. Wow.
Yeah. Well. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, I chose Netflix because I got out of bed, lie down on the sofa. I was by myself, nobody there. I was watching Netflix. All I concentrated on was what I was watching. So I didn't hear any other sounds, no screaming, no vibrations in the ground, nothing. I was in an environment where I could, to my thought, I could control everything.
Sure.
I wasn't exposed to anything.
You could also control what you were watching.
Exactly.
Which you can't
I had
on television.
Total control of everything.
Yep.
So I became a hermit. I isolated myself from my family, my wife, two kids, my parents, my sister, my friends, social activities, everything. I completely isolated myself. I lied about everything to everyone when I got invited. I would say yes, but when the event came up, I'd say, you know what, I'd find a reason and I'd lie. And obviously, people listening to this will find out for the first time. I'm sorry, but it is what it is. So I lied about everything. You know, I totally isolated myself. I didn't eat well. I didn't take care of myself in the sense that I was letting myself slowly die, if I can say that. You know, I never contemplated suicide.
No, no.
Because I was comfortable where I was, because I wasn't experiencing anything bad, because I was in a world I could control.
Did you feel as if, you know, this whole thing with Netflix, this whole thing, that if you told the truth, what did you fear would happen if you told people the truth of what was going on?
Well,
like you weren't going to the family reunion and you made up an excuse.
Yeah.
That kind of a lie.
Yeah.
What did you fear about the truth?
Well, my fear wasn't based on what I thought could happen. Something happened to me that created that fear. The question you asked before about when did I first discover? When I first discovered I had that issue, I was still serving. I had just come back from Afghanistan about a month, and I went to see one of my commanding officers, and I said, "Could I have a word with you in private, sir?" I was with reconnaissance, so we deal directly with command. We're not we're higher up in the chain of command. You know, we deal directly with them. So I went to see him and I said, "Could I talk with you in private?" He said, "Yeah." And obviously, I don't want people to think that everybody in the military is like that. That was a specific situation with a specific person, right? I said, "Listen, I need to speak to you in private." So we went to his office. That was on a Friday morning. And the reason why I remember it's a Friday morning, you'll find out. I said, "Listen, I have a problem. I can't sleep. I'm having nightmares. I'm constantly enraged. I'm having flashbacks. I'm constantly high on adrenaline. I can't sleep. So there's something wrong. I need help. What can I do?" And his answer was, "Okay, you take the rest of the afternoon off, take the weekend off, think about everything you've just talked to me about, and when you come back on Monday, that better be gone. Is that clear?"
Boy, if it was only that easy, eh?
Yeah, so I said, at that point, I convinced myself, you know what, I need to shut up and suffer in silence.
Okay.
So I lost confidence in other people. I lost confidence in everybody. So that's when I decided, you know what, I'm not going to talk about this. A year and a half later, I went to somebody else in the military. And his answer was, I said the same things. That was my second attempt. His answer was, "All right, that's okay. But here's what's going to happen. In 6 months, if you're not better, we're going to fill the paperwork to kick you out of the forces.
Oh, boy. Yeah.
So, you know, you don't want to be kicked out of the forces. You see that as your family, mm-hmm. you know? And they've always told you, whatever happens, we'll be there for you. But something happened, and both times, the impression I got is that my family wasn't there for me. So might as well shut up and endure this. So it just went, that second time, it went downhill. I came into work one morning and I dropped my gear on the counter and said to my boss, you know what, I'm going to medical and I'm done. This is it. I can't do this job anymore. So I went there and
that's an act of courage, by the way.
Well, thank you. Thank you. But that's when you know the whole medical aspect of started, where they diagnosed me with post-traumatic stress injury.
So tell me, you're the first person that I ever heard refer to it as post-traumatic stress injury. I like it, by the way.
Thank you.
Tell me the difference for you between post-traumatic stress injury and the term that used to be used, which is post-traumatic stress disorder. What do those two terms mean to you?
Well. When I first was diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, it was a term that was closely associated with a lot of stigma. Being in the military infantry, all that machoism of, you know, you're the tough guy, you're the soldier, you're the machine. As soon as you heard the word PTSD, I mean the acronym PTSD or mental problems, it was stigmatized. You were mm-hmm. seen as, you were branded as, actually branded, they called it NS, non-serviceable.
Oh, really?
They would say, oh, that person's NS. He's non-serviceable. So in the military, when you're something is non-serviceable, it means that you can't use it anymore. If it's a tool that you need, like a rifle, you need to, as your main tool in conflict zones and missions, if it's non-serviceable, you can't bring it in because it can't protect you. It'll make you fail the mission. So when they branded a person as non-serviceable, obviously, you were seen as
useless.
Useless.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a perfect term. Perfect term. So when I think about PTSD, it's closely associated with that stigma mm-hmm. and that feeling. When I got diagnosed with it, obviously, I started reading about it and wanted to know more about what was PTSD at the time, and discovered in my recent research that there's a lot of scientific research that supports the fact that it's not a disorder, it's an injury. And when I heard the word injury, I got this feeling that, you know what, I can get better. It's an injury, it's not a disorder. I'm not born with this. It comes from being exposed to high levels of threat and stress for extremely sustained time,
mm-hmm.
for seven, eight months of constant stress and threat and horror scenes and participating in attacks. You think about those and you say, well, you know what? I was fine before. There's no way this is a disorder. This is an injury. I can get better. I can work through this. And the games have helped me dive into the research. And when I talk to my friends and I use the word injury, I find that they're more inclined to talk about what they have. Because
mm-hmm.
they see, you know, it's not a disorder. Some people say, what do you call an injury? It's called PTSD. I said, well, it used to be called PTSD. It used to be called shell shock.
Yes.
You know? Times change, research moves forward, you know, science moves forward, and we're discovering these things. And if you look at the word operational stress injury, which I think PTSI is slowly going to,
yes,
coining the term OSI, I find that it's a lot easier for me to tell people, well, I have operational stress injury. People seem to be, when you use the word injury, they seem to be open to willing to talk about it. To discuss it without being judgmental.
Mm-hmm.
When you mention to people, I have post-traumatic stress disorder, automatically they think, okay, well, this person might be dangerous.
Or defective.
Or defective, yeah. Exactly. And they don't really see you as making it coming back from that that injury. So when I use the word injury, for me, there's a lot of relief that comes with it. There's the knowing that this is temporary. It's not as bad as the limits I've set myself because of this injury. There's more to life after being diagnosed with that.
Mm-hmm.
It might be, you know, what parts of it might stay with me for the rest of my life. But I know that it's an injury because since I've completed the games, a lot of things have changed positively. My recovery process has greatly moved forward. So it is an injury. It's not a disorder.
Tell me exactly what participating in the Invictus Games Orlando 2016, how did that change you?
Wow. We could sit here and talk about that whole day. To keep it short and simple, before the games, I was numb to everything.
Even though you were training and you were on the team, still in that time frame?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was either numb or mad. And you can ask Joe Corrali, who was a part of the administrative team for Soldier On. A couple of times I was rude to Joe. And I apologized for it, and he accepted, and he said, I understand, because I was put under a lot of stress. And obviously, I responded to that by being rude to certain situations.
You felt agitated.
Yes, mm-hmm. And I took it out on other people. So now I've gotten more in tune with my emotions. You know, I'm able to laugh. I've cried on some situations where I wasn't able to do that before. You know, when you're either extremely happy about certain things, like when my sons were born, I had no emotions, none whatsoever. I wasn't happy. I wasn't sad. I wasn't crying out of joy. I was just numb about it. You know, and since the games, you know, my sons made me cry because of their enthusiasm through certain things like karate, Jake learning to walk, Jake learning to talk. He's my youngest one. So all of these things are new to me. When I look back at the pictures of my son learning to walk in the video, now I laugh. Mm-hmm. You know, I've cried, and I can't believe because I look back and say, I can't believe I was numb throughout those situations. I've learned to understand what triggers me. I've learned to understand what I've associated in civilian life today with horrific scenes or conflict scenes back of my service, either in Afghanistan or Bosnia. I've learned to separate myself from that association that I've done with those, or better understand how PTSI affects me. Mm-hmm. One of my main things during the day, because I don't have panic attacks anymore, is if I get in a situation that triggers me, when I breathe, I smell the odors that are associated with horrific scenes.
The old smells.
Yes. Blood, charred skin, the sand, the air in Afghanistan, like 30% of what you breathe in Afghanistan is fecal matter. You can actually smell the fecal matter in the air. So I'll be in a room somewhere with air conditioning where they just cleaned up the room and something happens, I'm triggered. I know I'm in the room. I'm not having flashbacks, but the air I breathe smells exactly like it was in Afghanistan. So that's how strong OSIs are. Mm-hmm. You know, they're extremely strong. The brain is, it's unbelievable how it can get affected, you know. So I've learned to distance myself from those and better understand that I'm more active as a person. You know, I'm not on the sofa anymore. I participate in different social activities. I still have trouble participating in them, but I face them and I expose myself to these triggers. Some of them have not subsided. Some have. Not enough to say that I can function normally. I mean, there's always... Everything's always a challenge.
Mm-hmm.
I can't say I really enjoy it. I enjoy my time because I know it's a challenge, but it's something I must do, and I'm not going to quit. I keep exposing myself constantly to these events and go through the triggers, and it's not always comfortable. But I've noticed that in the time that I first started the Invictus Games process to this day, I've progressed so much that it has to happen. I have to continue. You know, I can't settle where I am right now. Although I'm happy where I am.
Yes.
My wife and my kids noticed a huge difference. You know, my youngest one, I connected with my youngest one at the games for the first time. You know,
wow.
I hadn't connected with him before, and that was extremely...
What was that moment?
When he came on stage with me. He came on stage with me when I got the medal. I asked my wife and my two kids to come on stage with me to take a picture on stage with the medal and my bow. And my son leaned up against me, and I actually felt him for the first time. I actually was aware of the contact. You know, it seemed like all the walls that I had built because of PTSI, many of them have fallen. That was one of the walls that had fallen.
That is a remarkable moment, honestly.
Yeah, it's unbelievable.
To ordinary people that are listening to this podcast, is there something that they can do to, first of all, respect the boundaries for somebody who's struggling with PTSI, but also to maybe in some way show support or help? Is there a way that you would like to share with people so that they know what to do?
I think the important thing is to have an open mind. I think the Canadian society has demonstrated throughout the years that it's very open to a lot of change. And I think it's something that we could put into recognizing mental illness. And I'll tell you a story of where somebody was there for me, and that brought a very positive change in my life. Somebody who I think noticed that I was having difficulty because of PTSI, and I was going through not a panic attack, but I had been triggered.
So a moment of discomfort, to say the least.
Yeah, exactly. It's very well said. I was in Orlando at the Invictus Games, and our team was participating in the swimming medal event. It was one of the last events. It was extremely hot.
And were you competing, Joel?
No, I was not competing. No, I was sitting in. I was in the stands, and the stands were a structured stand. So when people moved or jumped, bleachers exactly, they would the bleachers would move physically. You know, they would vibrate when people were jumping.
Sure.
So there were people screaming. There were kids screaming. There were. You could physically see the injuries. I mean, people were lost limbs.
Mm-hmm.
All of these things were, for me, triggers. The heat, I had just run out of water. I was surrounded by people in the middle of the crowd. Everything there was a trigger.
And the bleachers were shaking.
So that gave the effect of an explosion. You know,
mm-hmm.
For me, that's my perception of that feeling. And that's what my brain associated the feeling with. And... So I said, normally I would just leave and go home. You know, I said, I can't leave, I can't go home, but I realized that I couldn't digest these emotions. I couldn't process these emotions. So I said, I'll just get off the bleachers, go in the stairwell, and breathe a bit, you know. Just not leave, still be here, still hear the sounds, still hear the vibrations in the bleachers, but be in an environment where I have breathing room. So I went in the staircase, and it was sort of a funnel. There was a lot of air, so that made me feel good, you know, and refreshed me. It was relaxing. I noticed a volunteer came up to help me, and it came up to talk to me, and she said, are you okay? And I said, no. I said, yeah, I'm fine. Because I reverted back to that, I can't trust anybody.
Yep.
And tell them how I feel. So I'm going to suffer in silence. I said, no, I'm fine. I just want to be left alone. And she said, are you sure you're okay? Because you don't seem fine. Do you need anything? And that hit me right there, saying, well, wait a second here. That's right. I'm in Invictus Games. People aren't judging me. She said, can I get you a bottle of water? I said, yeah, I would love a bottle of water. So she went away, came back, gave me the bottle of water. She said, would you like to talk about it? Again, I reverted to that old feeling. I said, I just want to be left alone. I don't want to talk about it. And her response was, if you don't mind, I'll just stay right here next to you until you feel better.
Wow.
So I put my head down and I said, okay, sure. And in my head, I mean, I was going through all these memories of the times where I looked for help and I was turned down. And I stopped believing in people. I stopped believing in myself. And now I was in a situation where, you know what, right now somebody's trying to help me. I've completely pushed them away. I haven't given them a chance to do so. But that person is just staying there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, supporting me without really doing anything. Being present was doing something, but
yes.
not engaging in conversation or physical contact, putting her hand on my shoulder, whatever, give me a hug or whatever. None of that, just being there. To me, that specific event really helped my recovery process because it allowed me to gain confidence in people again.
Mm-hmm.
And that led me to the ability to participate in events just as this one, going in, doing interviews, revealing how I felt and how post-traumatic stress injury has affected my life. I wouldn't have done that before because I didn't trust anybody. I thought that I would be judged, I'd be stigmatized, I'd be laughed at, or considered non-serviceable, if I could use that expression again.
Yeah.
But that event, you know, it showed me that I can't generalize. I can't put everybody in the same basket. There's people out there to help me, and I'll take advantage of that. So if I, to better answer your question, I would say just being there for somebody who you think might be in sort of a crisis, a panic attack or whatever, just if they, no matter what they say, if they say, I don't want to talk to you, whatever, if you just stay close, you can keep eye contact with them. That's just that effect. Has a calming, just that gesture has a calming effect on, mm-hmm. on me.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and
well, and it's also, again, it's another act of courage for you to say, yes, I would like a bottle of water, because it sounds to me like the old Joel would have said, no, I'm fine. And in fact, that you allowed that little tiny opening to just say, yes,
yep.
It shows huge courage on your part. So that obviously was a life-changing moment for you. As you look forward, before I go there, I just want to say that it sounds to me like you are often there, as you say it, for your brothers. You know, when they are looking for something, sometimes it's the act of knowing that somebody can call you.
Yes.
That you don't, it's not what you say, it's not what you do, it's the fact that you're available.
Yes.
Do you think that that has made a difference for you also in your family life now? Being able to just be there, being able to have your child close to you. Does that feel good now?
Yes, beyond a doubt. I think that's one of the greatest feelings, you know, because of, it's not something I have an easy time to talk about, but because of PTSI, I wasn't able to be in the room with my wife when she gave birth to both of our children. You know,
too stressful.
I was triggered. I was,
yeah.
I remember I went to the hospital and that's when I first started having flashbacks, I think, like really intense flashbacks. For a moment, I was in the hospital, but sometimes I was out fighting because there were other childbirths in the hospital. And I remember stepping out of the room just right before I left the hospital. I'm sitting in the hallway, and nurses are coming by with carts and trays with the placenta mm-hmm. in the tray. So there's a lot of blood. Again, I get triggered. So I lost a sense of reality of where I was,
mm-hmm.
and I was now back in Afghanistan. So when I look at where I am today, obviously my relationship with my partner, Marie-André, has evolved to what I consider to be a very healthy relationship compared to what it was before. In a relationship, the aspect of the sexual part of it is very important. You know, the intimacy is very important, and PTSI affects your libido. Now, for the longest time, I had no interest in intimacy because I was numb.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't care for it. I didn't love it. I didn't want it. I just was numb. It wasn't important for me, you know. And everything's getting back into order. You know, my relationship with my kids. I'm able to connect with them. You know, we sit, we laugh, we cuddle. when my kid says he doesn't feel well about something, he's scared or he's tired, whatever, I can be there for him. You know, I can support him. I can give him advice. You know, the connection is, I've gotten so close with my family. Same with my friends. You know, people I had not talked to in a while, I got back in contact with. You know, and they understand. I've explained what happened, and they understand. It's like we never stop talking.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So tell me about hiking. We turned on the microphone, you were saying that you love activity. We weren't talking about sports, so tell me about the activities that you love to do.
Before I do that, I want to say that, you know, the games, Invictus Games, they say that the sport and activity are extremely good for the recovery process of PTSI and physical injuries, you know. And I don't practice specific sports like rowing or sprinting or swimming, you know. My main activities that I really enjoy are hiking, camping, and precision rifle shooting.
Okay.
I had never shot an arrow before the Invictus Games. I've shot one when I was 9 years old,
yeah.
But other than that, never in a competitive or with that type of a quality of gear. And so my sport is hiking, camping, and precision shooting firearms. And it's something that I really enjoyed doing before I got diagnosed with PTSI. Despite the fact that I was in the military infantry, we spent a lot of time exercise in rural areas. Even on my off time, I would go camping.
Mm-hmm.
I would go trekking in the woods. I would climb mountains. Whatever it was that was outside in the wilderness, I absolutely loved doing. I stopped doing that until after the games.
Oh, really?
Yeah. When I came back from the games, you know, people were asking me, so...
And this is just May of 2016. It's recently.
Yeah. I swear to God, BJ, if we met before the games to do this interview, you would see a totally different person. Entirely different person. What you viewed physically and both emotionally, it'd be a totally different person. I guarantee. And so since the games have been done, since I've been done with the games of May, the 16 games... you know, I go for walks in the woods. I've been camping. I go shooting with friends at the ranges where I'm a member of, and I'm just more active. And being out trekking in the woods, going for walks, I go with my family, go with my kids. I bring my kids doing that activity with me, and they enjoy it. My wife enjoys it. The dog comes with us. Everybody enjoys it. You know, the fresh air. Since I've started doing that again, it has helped me recover.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the calming effect of being in the woods, the smell. I don't get triggered in the wilderness. I don't. It's one of the few places where camping or hiking, despite the fact that we'll light a fire at night and stand around the fire, the smell of the burning wood or whatever, cooking and. I don't get triggered. I don't understand why, but I don't get triggered, you know. And the fact that I'm able to participate in those activities, the more and more I find the energy to do so, the more I want to do it. So the games have allowed me not to, because hiking is not considered an Olympic event of some sorts. They don't
yet.
Maybe. Hey, who knows? Maybe it'll happen. But hiking for me is my sport. It's my activity. I've done it more in the last 5 months than I've done it in the last 10 years.
Wow, that's amazing.
Yeah, because I stopped doing everything. You know, I've lost weight. I'm getting healthier. I'm eating better. I'm drinking a lot of water. I quit drinking water. All I was drinking was Pepsi.
Okay.
Because I need the
not
caffeine.
Not as good for you.
Exactly. I need the caffeine to stay up and to get that rush from the adrenaline rush that the sugar gives you, you know. So it's all been positive changes. So when we say about, when we talk about Invictus Games and the benefits of sports and activity, definitely there are benefits to it. And Invictus Games was the kick in the butt I needed.
That's amazing. Okay, last question.
Yes.
You have been on an unbelievable journey from childhood all the way through your military service to today. I would love for you to tell me your favorite three qualities about yourself today.
My favorite, okay.
Besides devilishly handsome.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. That wasn't one of them. I was not thinking about one of them. When I look at myself today, I would say, first and foremost, a good father.
That's a great one.
I would say, first and foremost, I'm a good father. Second, I would say I'm a good friend and partner to my wife and my friends. And third, I would say I'm back at being my resilience.
That's amazing.
I refuse to quit. I'm back where I was before I got hit with that. You know, no matter what I tried, I always refused to quit. No matter how hard, no matter how many times I was going to be told, you know, you're too old to do that. You're too old. You won't survive that. There's no way you can accomplish that. I made it through everything, you know. I made it through everything, and I was chosen to do things that people were saying, it's never going to happen, Joel. You're too old. And I'm back at that stage of my life where, you know, I have that resilience against. I don't quit.
You know what? The world needs more Joel Gendon. Thank you so much for talking to me.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been amazing talking with you.
It's been extraordinary for me too. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Invictus Games Radio. For more information, visit www.invictusgames2017.com.